Well, what I want to say is the big problem is what can be done, what can happen when you've got this sort of thing. As long as you read Jung and you say, well, he's really after the same thing I'm after, but his language is different. Okay, but what to follow out of that, out of the language, is where the difficulty lies. What mainly can follow out of it is drifting with the victimized complexes and relinquishing moral responsibility for them, instead of taking responsibility for seeing to their transformation, whatever that might be. Whatever might be. It does happen, and it is promoted, I think, that I've got to do evil, see, in the sense of giving way to displacement in order to become good. I don't agree.
I understand the sections you've gone through before. Somehow I can't quite fit them together. Limitation, transcendence, the creative process, and the search for meaning. You put them all together
in a sentence?
Or diagram it better.
Well, the search for meaning is one dimension of the creative process, huh? The search for meaning is, you know, be attentive, intelligent. Intelligence is what pursues meaning. Reasonable, pursue true meaning. Responsible, pursue the good. The love of God and your fellow men and women, you see. That's the creative process. That is. You need the healing process in order to be able to live the creative process. What was the other one you wanted to
do? No, that was limitation to transcendence.
Oh, all right. Yeah. The limitation transcendence thing is the creative process is the intentionality, spirit vector in the human person, which is permeated by the affective psychic vector, which has its roots in the body and yet reaches into the spirit. And it's in the psychic that the tension of limitation and transcendence is experienced, you see. The creative vector itself is what makes for transcendence in human living. Okay? It's in the psychic, however, that we feel the tension between that and the limitations that are imposed upon our creativity by being in incarnate subjects. The psychic feels the participation in both of those. Is that something along
with
that?
All done with the hat.
A human being.
Doing what?
Living. Flourishing. Creating. Being healed and healing. Participating. Participating in the divinely originated solution to the problem of evil. And all kinds of other things. Okay. The psyche and ethical responsibility, number 10 on the outline. What I just said to Terry is the beginning on this. The tense unity of limit and transcendence is felt by the psyche. It is felt by the psyche. The psyche experiences through feeling a participation in both body and spirit. It experiences that in its feelings, in feeling. It experiences a participation in both body and spirit. But that taught balance of body and spirit is not the word I want to use is it's not posited by the psyche. It is not placed in existence
by the psyche. It is experienced in the psyche, but it is posited by human freedom. It's posited by the spirit. It is a function, perhaps the way of saying what I mean by positive. It is a function of good choices. It is the spirit, the human spirit's responsibility, to the extent that it is within my power to have something to say over my own psychic health. It is my freedom. It is by free choices that I posit the state of my psyche. Now, it's also posited, of course, by others' free choices. Of the mystery of sin in the world. The sins of the fathers are handed on to the children up to the third and fourth, perhaps 25th, 26th generations. But at the root of psychic flourishing or disintegration is what human beings have chosen. Freedom is at the root of that, both in the sense of original sin and in the sense of personal sin. Original, in the sense also of good choices. Freedom is at the root of it. What is ultimately responsible for the balance or imbalance of human psyches is human freedom. Or to put it another way, insofar as my own psychic state is my doing, and, you know, I think you should be very aware from everything we've said all through the course, it's not completely my doing. But insofar as it is my doing, it is a function of what I want and what I choose. Am I living a life in which what I choose is constituting me as a subject, living in that in-between of limit and transcendence? I think this is a fundamental question in psychic self-appropriation and psychotherapy. Am I living a life in which what I choose is constituting me as a subject living in the in-between of limit and transcendence? And ultimately, psychotherapy has to get at human choices. Ultimately, somewhere along the line, it has to get at human choices. What kind of a person am I becoming as a result of my decisions? To answer that question, I can turn to the affective register of my own psyche and ask, am I genuinely living in that in-between of limit and transcendence? Do I experience myself moving toward that equilibrium, that taut balance, that creative tension, limit and transcendence? Next week I'm going to show how I would take that taut balance as being a basic criterion of discernment. Basic criterion of Christian discernment. Are my choices moving me into ever fuller integration of limit and transcendence? That is to say, ever more fully into the truth of my humanity. So that's what I'm getting at there under number 10, the psyche and ethical responsibility. To put it very simply, the psyche is not the source of ethical responsibility, but my psychic state insofar as it's my doing, is a function of my ethical responsibility. It's a function of the choices that I have made and am making. It's not the source of it, but it's where I can feel what my freedom is doing. And so it's a good place to turn to try to get some hold on the choices that I am making. Or in the language of the spiritual tradition, it's a good place to turn to get some hold on discernment. It's not at all accidental in the spiritual exercises of St. Ignatius that all the rules for the discernment of spirits deal with affectivity. Every one of them. Okay, any questions, John?
If I could flip back to you for a second.
Yeah.
My focus here is definitely on choice and human freedom. Does Jung, too, ask a person to make choices?
He never adequately thematizes, objectifies in his writings, the issue of decision. In other words, he will he'll give indications that he's aware of it, but he has never articulated clearly its relationship to the psychic, as far as I've been able to find in my study of him. To thematize the role of decision in psychotherapy, it's mentioned in passing. Along the line, you know, a person had certain warnings from dreams and so on and so forth, but didn't make use of them. Okay? But to actually sit down and thematize what the role of decision is with regard to, let's say, those warnings, it's not there. It's not worth going. Do now the section on Kierkegaard, on dread, and the human synthesis. And just kind of to introduce here a comparison between Jung and Kierkegaard. Let's start by saying this, that Kierkegaard was a thinker who was sensitive to the same problems that we are discussing and that we've been discussing for the last several weeks. He was sensitive to it, and he speaks, whereas I speak of the integration of limitation and transcendence, he uses the term positing the human synthesis. Positing the human synthesis. Taking my material on Kierkegaard from several books, the concept of dread it's cheery titles for his book. The concept of dread, fear, and trembling. The sickness unto death. And either or. His expression about positing the human synthesis occurs in the concept of dread. And it supports very much what I just said about the relationship between the psyche and freedom. But in fear and trembling and the sickness unto death, he adds yet another dimension that has to be brought in for the full story on moral responsibility. even when you recognize the role of freedom vis-a-vis the psyche, that is to say, ethical responsibility and its relationship to psychic maturity. Ethical responsibility is not the final word. There comes a point where the ethical itself has to give way, has to be suspended. That's Kierkegaard's terminology, the suspension of the ethical. It has to be suspended, not in order to fall back into drifting, but in order to hand oneself over into the power of God. The ethical can be carried too far. I can become a person attempting to be the source of my own being through my own ethical responsibility. And at that point, ethical responsibility turns into evil. Or what starts out as good is gotten a hold of by another tendency and becomes a source of disintegration. Once ethical responsibility takes over and makes me what Becker calls the causa sui, very similar to what St. Ignatius talks about in the exercises as a movement that starts out as good and is perverted along the way to the source of evil. So that's another thing that Kierkegaard is very sensitive to. He's very sensitive to ethical responsibility, that it is in my freedom that I posit the psychic state that I have, that I'm in. I'm responsible for my own psychic state, at least up to a certain point. But he's also very sensitive to the fact that ethical responsibility is not the final word in my own development. There comes a point in which if I try to make it the final word, it becomes distorted. And that's what he means by the suspension of the ethical. It has to be suspended at a certain point so that I give myself over into the hands of God, who is the one who makes me. God is ultimately the source of the synthesis that I become, that I am. I am not the ultimate source of the synthesis of body and spirit. The ultimate source of that synthesis is the one who makes me who I am. Now, in Kierkegaard, because of his Lutheran background, Augustinian, Pauline, Augustinian, and Lutheran background, the religious sphere of existence is radically a matter of faith. And so the movement from the ethical to the religious is a movement, is a leap of faith. And that's his expression, the leap of faith. For Lonergan, whom I'm following, coming out of the Thomistic background, the radical factor in the religious dimension is charity, is love. And faith is the eye of love. Is the knowledge that is born of religious love. So Kierkegaard will be a little bit different from myself on what radically constitutes the religious dimension. For me, the radical element in the religious dimension is the gift of God's love, out of which faith is born. In Kierkegaard's writings, the radical dimension and the radical element in the religious dimension is faith, which is entered into by a leap. And there is not much of a description in his writings of the experience of God's love as being the source of that leap of faith.
May I ask, in this leap, is there are the grounds for that leap logically presented? That's certainly a case of the Augustine.
In retrospect, or as one is making the leap? In reflection back upon it, is there a logic to it?
Yeah.
Oh, I think, yeah, I would say that in Kierkegaard, too. But the leap itself is not a logical moment. It's not, you know, it's not a syllogism, you know, where major, minor, and therefore I will leap. It's not that kind of leap at all. But reflecting back upon it, can you discuss it in a logical way? Yes. And he does. There's great logic. In fact, he learned his reasoning from Hegel, who had developed the dialectical method, you know, to perfection. So Hegel is, Kierkegaard is using that. So it's extremely intelligent.
Does he make reference to Hegel's treatment of the beautiful soul?
Not that I remember. He may. In these writings, not the ones which I'm working with. Okay, let's break for 10 minutes and we'll come back. What I just gave you on Kierkegaard is just an introduction. I'm going to go through in detail how he deals with it.